This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me. We've got 2 hours in front of us where we're going to talk about some of the things that matter most. Second hour today, we're going to open the phone lines at 1-877-573-7825. It's coming up at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. 1-877-573-7825 to discuss the situation surrounding the Covington Catholic High School students. The Bishop of Lexington, Kentucky now, according to the Lexington Herald Leader, Bishop John Stowe, says he's, quote, ashamed of the boys' actions and astonished that they were wearing Trump hats. By the way, a fraction of them were wearing Trump hats. Some of them bought them on the streets of D.C. Some of them wore them from home, but it was, he makes it sound like they were wearing a uniform or something. I have to say, why are these bishops so hesitant to listen to the experience of the boys and the chaperones and the parents? Where are they getting their information? We're doing our best to bring up all the information we possibly can. And I don't hear that in these Episcopal statements. We're going to talk about this whole issue of how, in a sense, these boys check off every line of the deplorable list. They were white. They're from the South. They're pro-life. They're Catholic. They wore red hats that said, Make America Great Again. And they're teenagers. These according to Hillary Clinton, those would be the deplorables. And that's one reason we've got this problem. We're going to talk about it. Also, we're going to talk with Dr. Matthew Bunsen about some new questions surrounding Bishop Zangetta. And then an abortionist win in New York, and they're trying to win in Virginia. Two guests joining us to follow that. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 24th. It's the Feast of St. Francis de Sales. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. Learn more at visitingangels.com. America's top diplomat says former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has no legal authority to break diplomatic relations. Speaking today in Washington, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that means the U.S. will not withdraw diplomats from Venezuela despite Maduro ordering them to leave. Pompeo once again declared Maduro's regime illegitimate and morally bankrupt. President Trump's proposal to end the partial government shutdown is hitting a stone wall in the Senate. A vote to move the plan forward failed to hit the 60-vote threshold today. Trump's compromise would trade temporary protections for Dreamers for border wall funding. Senators are now voting on a Democratic bill extending funding for affected agencies and departments to February 8th. That measure is also expected to fall short. Yesterday at this time, we told you of a developing story in Central Florida where multiple people had been shot in a hostage situation at a Florida bank. Today, police in Florida say 5 women were killed.
Zeph and Alan Zaver knowingly and intentionally took the lives of 5 of our fellow community members, our sisters, our mothers, our daughters, and our coworkers.
Sebring Police Chief Carl Hoglund says Zaver entered the SunTrust Bank and immediately made contact with, then shot, 4 bank employees and 1 customer. Zaver has no known connections to the bank or anyone inside. Prosecutors have said they will seek the highest penalty possible. And a Texas diocese is planning to release a list of priests accused of sexual abuse. A Corpus Christi diocese spokesperson tells the NBC affiliate in the coastal town that the names will be made publicly by the end of the month. It's expected to contain accusations dating back to the 1950s. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Continuing conversation with me, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, senior contributor to EWTN News and the National Catholic Register. He's a senior fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology and the author or co-author of more than 50 books. Good to have you again.
Oh, always good to be with you. As always, we wish there were happier topics to be discussing.
Well,
I think that's the state of affairs for all of us now.
Yeah, for the time being, I think the mess is going to be something we're going to have to shovel away every time we get together. It's going to be a while before we can, I think, get through this. In particular, today we're talking about new questions that have surfaced regarding Bishop Zangetta. Why don't you set this, frame that for us so if listeners haven't heard us discuss this in the past, they understand why Bishop Zanchetta is a source of concern.
Well, this is significant because he was a bishop in Argentina. He was the bishop of Oran, Argentina, who was actually named by Pope Francis. And he subsequently resigned his office in August of 2017 under what were peculiar circumstances. He claimed problems with his health as well as what was described as challenges in managing his relationship with his diocesan clergy and the priests of the diocese, and what was an incapacity to govern his clergy. Now, that's not unheard of in the history of the Church. He was subsequently moved to Rome, where he was given a position by Pope Francis in what's known as APSA, which is the administration of the patrimony of the Apostolic See. That is the Vatican office that oversees the massive holdings of the Holy See in terms of real estate and other assets. It's a position that was, my understanding is, essentially created for him. He was a type of assessore or a counselor. And then it was revealed in January, just this January, that he'd received accusations of alleged sexual misconduct against the bishop. And the accusations had come in the fall, it was pointed out, of 2018. And the Vatican reiterated and continues to reiterate that it did not know at the time of his appointment by Francis that they were aware of these allegations. That now is being called into question from a couple of different fronts.
So this is a man who lost the confidence of his presbyterate. And he admitted that he was unable to govern in his diocese. At that time, the Vatican claims that they had no direct information about his sexual improprieties?
That was the statement from the Sola Stampa, the Holy See Press Office. Now, that was then challenged by an exclusive report from the Associated Press that relied heavily on the former vicar for the Argentine bishop, Bishop Zanchetta. And his assertions were that, in fact, the Vatican was informed prior to that, prior to 2017 and 2015, that not just that there were problems of relationships with his priests, but in fact that there were problems of obscene behavior, sexual harassment of adult seminarians, and even sort of gross sexual imagery and photos on the bishop's phone, and that those had been reported to the Holy See. Then it became additionally complicated because we fall back into the question, as we have been dealing with the whole McCarrick scandal, as to what do we mean by the Holy See was informed.
Right.
And it turns out, of course, that those charges, those allegations were done in an informal way rather than a formal way, which raises, as it has throughout the whole McCarrick scandal, the question of how exactly are these being handled, and is it not the case that we clearly need a much better system for reporting these things?
Yeah. So at this point then, has Pope Francis made any personal statement on Zanchetta?
Not that I'm aware of. And the Holy See reiterated through the Sola Stampa again. It was a communique issued just a couple of days ago from Alessandro Gisotti, who's the interim spokesperson for the Holy See. He actually complained that there were some misleading reports about Bishop Zanchetta, and that they simply went back to their statement issued in early January, arguing that he had resigned from his diocese in Argentina for reasons of poor relations, and then reiterating again that while there were accusations of authoritarianism, there had not been any accusations of sexual abuse. So that's a position that the Holy See seems to be digging its heels in. The question again emerges, though, as the AP is reporting, but also as Edward Penton from the National Catholic Register, that there are a lot more questions that are just emerging. We know that Pope Francis was instrumental in appointing Bishop Zanketa to the See of Oran. It was one of his very first appointments. Now, I'm not saying that Pope Francis is guilty of anything.
Right.
What I'm getting at is that this is a significant story.
Yes.
Because of the obvious ties of this bishop to Pope Francis, and the surprising move of bringing him to Rome in 2017 after his resignation from Argentina.
The Pope had sent him to receive some sort of psychiatric counseling to a Jesuit priest, right?
That's correct, yeah. It's a Jesuit priest, Father Germán Arana, and that's a name that's probably unknown to most people. But, as Edward Penton has reported, Francis has sent a number of bishops with pretty difficult situations to Father Arana. He's a Spanish-based Jesuit for psychiatric counseling. Now, some of the names might be known. One was Chilean Bishop Juan Barros, who, of course, very famously resigned from the Diocese of Osorno and was involved in the whole Chilean disaster of last year. Another was a bishop from Honduras, Juan José Pineda Fascuele, who stepped down as auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of Tegucigalpa for very similar allegations of the abuse of seminarians, as well as a lot of questions about his financial activities. That's significant because he was an auxiliary and the most trusted lieutenant under Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga of Tegucigalpa, Honduras, who, of course, is one of the key figures in this pontificate. So once again, we have a number of names that are attached very clearly to scandal of a particular type.
Yeah, abusing seminarians, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Who are sent to a Jesuit priest for counseling.
And Zanketa is one of them.
A pattern has been established.
Yeah. So, this is part of the problem, I think, when all those things shakes out. It's going to be interesting to see the degree, if there's any significant acceptance of greater transparency when this is all over, because I think Catholics around the world are suffering right now a lack of confidence in the administrative competence of the Church institutionally. Most people, common sense, would say if you're sending Zanketa to a priest who's recognized as a specialist in this area of treating a certain type of sexual misconduct, then most of us would conclude that that's one of the problems that Zanketa is dealing with. But apparently we don't have anybody who's willing to say that on the record.
Right, and that I think would be subject then to further investigation by the Holy See, which the Holy See declares is actually happening, and if all of the allegations are found to be credible, he would then be sent to a specific group of judges subject to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and the Congregation for Bishops. What I mean is that the Holy See will be responsible for administering justice in this case.
Yeah.
Now, it's notable that in all of the reporting that has been done by the AP, by Edward Penton, the Vicar General in this case, going back to the Argentine diocese where Bishop Zanketa is from, and we're talking about Father Juan José Manzano, who's a former Vicar General, is not actually accusing Pope Francis of any improper conduct. In fact, he's saying just the opposite, that Pope Francis, in all likelihood, was duped or misled.
Okay.
Now, that's notable, again, because what it says is that Pope Francis was deceived, which is one of the accusations that was made regarding a lot of the events in Chile. And Pope Francis, of course, apologized for what he referred to as errors of perception and judgment in how he handled the cases in Chile last year. And it would not surprise me if somewhere down the road a similar type of a statement is issued regarding Bishop Zanketa, or will they simply handle this very quietly? Now, overhanging all of this, of course, is a word that we're still waiting for on the outcome of the investigation, trial, whatever, however the Vatican is handling this, of now Archbishop, former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick.
Right, right. Do we know, it was thought that this was going to be settled, the McCarrick judgment would be settled prior to the February meeting. Is that still believed?
Yes, I think the working assumption is that given the way that they're doing the trial, which is an administrative process, I'll leave it to the canonists to explain exactly how all of that works, but an administrative process is one that proceeds very quickly because of the sheer weight of the evidence in a particular case. The assumption is that the Holy See would like this trial done and over with before the start of the February summit, which of course is the 21st to the 24th of next month, on sex abuse at the Vatican. And I think the other expectation is, perhaps even as early as this weekend, if rumors, and I stress again, these are just rumors, if the speculation is true, there will be a new Archbishop of Washington, at least announced, prior to the February meeting as well. So I think there's an effort here to get the McCarrick case done and off the book, so to speak, prior to the February meeting so that they can focus all of their attentions on that gathering.
And prior to the appointment of a new bishop?
They could very well be about the same time.
Yeah.
And the problem is that depending upon how the announcement is made of the McCarrick trial, the verdict, and the results, there still may be many questions that will remain unanswered, as we have seen with the Zanketa case. About the particulars that we've been asking about and you have been asking for since the story broke last June.
Matthew, can you stay with us longer? I want to talk about World Youth Day if we can.
Yes, I can.
With me is Dr. Matthew Bunsen. We're, again, reviewing some of the stories in the church which are not handled with any great detail in the secular press. I'm Al Cresta.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, Huron Valley School, holding its open house Sunday, January 27th from 1 to 3 p.m. Come see St. John Bosco's educational philosophy in practice. Meet the teachers, current families, and experience what makes Huron Valley a special place. If you have a message you want to share, be a day sponsor at 877-288-1077.
Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services, a ministry of the Archdiocese of Detroit, is currently seeking family service advisors to be part of our ministry serving God's people. If you believe establishing relationships with families is an act of service and faith, this may be your place. If you believe inviting families to learn about our services is an act of favorable kindness, this may be your place. If you believe working for a church organization is rewarding and invigorating, this may be your place. And if you believe you are a servant of God, helpful to His people, this is your place. If you believe these words spoke to your heart, the Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services is looking for you. If you have a sales background and are committed to helping people, we would love to hear from you. We offer benefits, pension programs, paid vacations, and the opportunity to serve God's people. For more information, please call 248-204-0079. 248-204-0079.
Experience life as a Falcon. Join the Divine Child Catholic Schools community on Sunday, January 27th from 1 to 3 p.m. for their annual winter open house. For more than 60 years, Divine Child has been dedicated to instilling Catholic values and nurturing students' growth spiritually, academically, creatively, and socially. So join them and learn more about the Home of the Falcons.
Visit D.C. on Sunday, January 27th. For more information, visit divinechild.org. That's divinechild.org.
The nonprofit Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the second Healing the Breach of Trust Conference, February 6th in our nation's capital. Engage with some of the best Catholic minds in the country, including Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, President of the U.S. Bishops Conference, for a discussion about the historical and theological background of the crises of leadership in the Church and what the role of the laity might play in the Church renewal. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
On Putting on the Mind of Christ this week, we continue with our talks from the recent Call to Holiness Conference with Jeff Capens and Raymond Arroyo.
They entice you and your children to sit on the floor or on the couch and soak up the daily catechism, the ever-shifting politically correct toxin that lies at the heart of this new magisterium. Who is the new magisterium? Our name is media, and we are many. The media has become its own magisterium. It hands out its own version of the truth. We have penetrated every part of your life, and we've reshaped it.
This is Henry Root, your host and program producer for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Jeff Caven speaks about the Eucharistic sacrifice, and Raymond Arroyo talks about the electronic magisterium on the next Putting on the Mind of Christ. Join us this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEL and 1440 WMAX for Putting on the Mind of Christ.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. We're reviewing some stories that are of special interest to Catholics, of course, but are largely ignored in the mainstream press. World Youth Day, for instance, a story not getting much attention that I can see in the mainstream press, and yet, of course, for the youth gathered in Panama City, it's a major, it could be a life-changing event. What are you hearing about World Youth Day?
So far, that Pope Francis, who landed last night from Rome, went directly to the Apostolic Nunciature in Panama itself, and essentially the World Youth Day is starting today. So we had a welcoming ceremony, or will, at the main entrance of the Palacio for the presidency of Panama. And then he will be holding, in fact, I think, just today, he was meeting with the Central American bishops in a church there in Panama. So we will be reading with great interest whatever his comments are, given the state of affairs facing so many of the particular churches across Central America. And all eyes are also focused on Pope Francis, as whether he'll say something at perhaps that gathering or elsewhere about the catastrophe that is striking the country of Venezuela.
Yeah, that's something that we should keep in mind. Have the bishops weighed in on the political conflict there, and some people feeling as though a civil war might be in brewing in Venezuela?
Well, the local bishops in Venezuela have been adamantly opposed to the socialist and pretty brutal regime of President Maduro. The Holy See, however, has made the decision, and I can understand why it would do that, of maintaining, at least keeping alive, diplomatic relations with the government. For example, it sent a representative to Maduro's inauguration, which elicited quite a bit of criticism of the Holy See for doing that. But the importance of their relationship, but also to be a possible sounding board or even a possible conduit for Maduro's, what we hope will be his eventual resignation and handing over the government to what was actually a democratically elected series of leaders.
Yeah.
And I think the Holy See could have a role in that. So I speaking entirely personally, I understand why the Holy See might want to maintain at least some semblance of relations with them.
Yeah, the United States has withdrawn its recognition of Maduro as the national leader and has decided to support one of his opponents. And the question will be, what kind of international impact that will have.
That's right. And we know that Pope Francis has used, for example, the thawing of relations with Cuba as a way of opening a door to dealing with some of these other incompetent, corrupt socialist regimes that we find now strewn across much of Latin America. I'm thinking in particular of Venezuela, and of course Cuba stands at the sort of the very top of those types of regimes. And I think that's one of the reasons why they have chosen to try to maintain those diplomatic relations. It's another reason also for just the humanitarian reasons and needs that may eventually be allowed to receive some help. The Holy See is also, I think, concerned about potential violence against priests, bishops, and lay people all across Venezuela as the situation continues to deteriorate.
Do we have any predictions on attendance at World Youth Day yet?
Yeah, so far the attendance has been very good. Hundreds of thousands is my understanding. And the Pope has received a very warm welcome, which I think, as we saw in places like Chile, where he was greeted with a lot of protests, unusual for what would be ostensibly, we all assume, is a solidly Catholic part of the world. The reception that popes tend to get at World Youth Days are always exuberant. And I'm looking forward, actually, to hearing what Pope Francis has to say to the young people there. And, again, whether he'll make any reference to some of the ongoing global crises. I expect, as the Holy See has reiterated, he's not going to speak directly about Venezuela, but given the situation there, I'm sure that they're monitoring the situation very closely.
I wanted to also ask you to bring up Cardinal Mueller's recent statements that we should not look to clericalism alone as an explanation for why we've had so much sexual misconduct, or so many reports of sexual misconduct.
Yeah, this is an ongoing theme with Cardinal Mueller, and I think I'm one of those people that I'm very grateful that he's continuing to speak out about this. What we're seeing with him is that he's willing to take this head on. And one of the things that I think he finds very frustrating is this idea of reducing clergy sexual abuse to this sort of vague notion of clericalism, which we're seeing. And it concerns a lot of observers and analysts that as we head into this February meeting, that the vagueness of the very term, and
right.
in much the same way they had a certain vagueness of terminology with synodality,
right. Right.
That it obscures more than it actually illuminates.
Yeah, I agree. If you don't define what we're talking about here in exactly the degree to which clericalism is a problem with this present ecclesial culture, you don't know what you're talking about. The term has been abused. Some people have used even recognition of holy orders as a form of clericalism. And this is absurd. You have more liberal theologians like Paul Lakeland who see clericalism in the very willingness to keep laity as laity and clergy as clergy. Some people would like to break down the wall that exists between the ordained and the lay state. And certainly those of us who think that there's been a problem here are not talking about the removal of the Sacrament of Holy Orders. What do you think the problem is with referring to clericalism as an element, understanding this abuse crisis?
Well, I think that Cardinal Mueller put it extremely well, that he considers it sort of an injustice against our Lord, who gave, as he says, spiritual power and authority to the apostles and to the bishops with their priests. And the thing that we have to recognize, as Cardinal Mueller stresses it repeatedly in these interviews, that the majority of the abuse cases are not due to the sacrament of holy orders, but
right.
to sexual incontinence.
Right. See, this is a good example. So
Or a perverse understanding of human sexuality, and abandonment of the sixth commandment. So all of the things that, if we are faithful, especially if you're someone in orders, if you are faithful to what you were called to be, we're not going to have these problems.
Right.
But we also use clericalisms at times, I think, as a dodge for avoiding inconvenient or very impolite or non-PC conversations. And one of those is predatory homosexual activity in the seminaries and in the dioceses of the world.
So he sees clericalism as an attack upon holy orders.
I think he does, yeah. I obviously can't speak for him, but one of the things that he finds is that he was asked, in fact, that this idea of pushing clericalism as an argument that does not actually involve anything about homosexuality, this predatory homosexual behavior. He says that they don't want to confront this, in part because, in some cases, they have a very clear agenda of fighting against celibacy, against the
right
commandment, and so they see this as a way of advancing an agenda of a discussion that focuses on a very narrow aspect of the wider sex abuse crisis. Important as it is, and we take nothing away from the dire importance of the protection of minors, creating a safe environment, making sure that these cases are dealt with, the witnesses are heard, the victims are dealt with. But if we're going to deal with this in a comprehensive way, we have to look at every possible reason for the sex abuse crisis.
Right.
And that entails things like homosexuality, which the Ruth Institute has been studying very closely, the abandonment of celibacy, and the sexual revolution.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Unfortunately, we've got very different definitions of clericalism floating around here. The most common definition, as I understand it, is that clericalism refers to the kind of internal attempt on the part of clergy to abuse their authority over laity, in fact, confuse the authority they have through the Sacrament of Holy Orders with the use of power over laity in the same way that police can use their authority in improper ways. I thought most people would understand clericalism as a misuse of the special status conferred upon priests and bishops by the Sacrament of Holy Orders. But he's seeing the charge of clericalism as code for attacking the Sacrament of Holy Orders in particular. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, and I think... to be fair to Pope Francis, and Cardinal Mueller has mentioned this himself, that Pope Francis has been very clear in his opposition to homosexuals in the priesthood. And it makes then sort of the confusion that is often surrounding the use of the term clericalism very unhelpful when we're having a conversation regarding clergy sexual abuse. I'd add, too, to your very helpful definition of clericalism as one of the things that can also be used as a defining element of clericalism is this idea of separation, that you are removed somehow from the very flock over whom you are asked to serve,
yeah,
as shepherd and caretaker.
Yeah.
That you are somehow elite and above them.
Yes, exactly.
And that's a very valid complaint, I think, that can be made and has been made over the years. And it's something that, in fairness again to Pope Francis, he talks about the need for the shepherds to have the smell of the sheep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I think, is a healthy approach to trying to rid ourselves of clericalism within the church. But let's not use that then as an excuse to obscure other problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if you can't recognize that your priest is your brother before he's your father, you're going to have problems. And I think we've had... But the idea of referring to clericalism as the problem here without mentioning homosexuality is ludicrous. All right, Matthew, thanks so much.
Great to be with you. God bless.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruise, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's 2 coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net. Holy Spirit Roman Catholic School is a top-performing school in the Diocese of Lansing. This fully accredited school is located in South Brighton. Their mission? To offer a distinctly Catholic formation of children and youth through excellence in education. Since their opening in 2001, their goal is to integrate the teaching and practice of the Catholic faith into their students and families while simultaneously providing a quality academic education. Call 810-900-9050 to schedule a tour or go to holyspiritrcs.org. The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, deli, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalace.net. You want what's best for your child. That's why Everest Academy invites you to their open house Sunday, January 27th between 1 and 4 p.m. At Everest, they focus their efforts on helping your child excel in 4 main areas: academics, spiritual formation, character development, and service to others. The result? Confident, accomplished Catholic leaders, ready to transform the world according to the standards of the gospel. Visit EverestCatholic.org to learn more. That's EverestCatholic.org. The nonprofit Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the second Healing the Breach of Trust Conference, February 6th in our nation's capital. Engage with some of the best Catholic minds in the country, including Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, President of the U.S. Bishops Conference, for a discussion about the historical and theological background of the crises of leadership in the Church and what the role the laity might play in the Church renewal. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
Recently, a 3-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit unanimously ruled that King County's rejection of our client's Faces of Global Terrorism ad violated the First Amendment. The ad included the faces of 16 terrorists found on the FBI's Most Wanted Global Terrorist List, which is posted on the FBI's website. King County, which is located in Seattle, Washington, rejected our client's ad, claiming that the ad was demeaning and disparaging toward Muslims, since all of the listed terrorists, you guessed it, were Muslims. At the time, the FBI's Most Wanted Terrorist List included pictures and wanted posters for 32 terrorists. Of the 32 listed terrorists, 30 were individuals with Muslim names or were wanted for terrorism related to organizations conducting terrorist acts in the name of Islam. In its ruling, the Ninth Circuit held that the county's rejection of the ad based on its disparagement standard was viewpoint discrimination, and that its rejection of the ad based on its disruption standard was unreasonable, all in violation of the First Amendment. Make no mistake, this is an important victory for free speech. Too often we are seeing government officials restricting speech based on claims that is demeaning, disparaging, or offensive. The First Amendment does not allow such censorship, as the Ninth Circuit's opinion makes clear. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Well, New York City's One World Trade Center was lit up pink on Tuesday to celebrate the passage of the Reproductive Health Act. That's a law that's expanding and protecting so-called abortion rights in the state, regardless of what happens at the Supreme Court. So the bill legalizes abortion through the 9th month of pregnancy. This is, again, under state authority, and rolls back protections for babies who survive a botched abortion. Governor Andrew Cuomo, a self-identified Catholic, celebrated the bill, and he demanded that it be passed before he would sign off on a state budget. Joining me right now to discuss this, Dr. Michael New. He's visiting assistant professor at the Catholic University of America and an associate scholar at the Charlotte Legere Institute. Michael, good to have you with me.
Good to be on, Al. Thanks for having me.
What a What a cheap thing to do for a man who identifies as a Catholic.
Yeah, I agree. It's really an awful piece of legislation. I mean, frankly, again, it does clearly legalize abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy in New York. Even worse, if, for as bad as that is, it allows non-physicians, gives them the ability to do abortions. So physician assistants, nurses, midwives, these people can now perform abortions. This isn't good for the New York health of New York women. It's certainly not good for the unborn. This is just a truly awful piece of legislation.
This doesn't even recognize a tragic dimension to abortion. It celebrates abortion.
Right.
I mean, it's so here we have a self-identified Catholic with a nationally recognizable name. I'm just wondering, did Cardinal Dolan say anything about this? Did the Archdiocese fight it? Who did what?
I mean, the New York Catholic Conference did oppose it, and they were vocal in doing so. I haven't really looked at all the bishops, the statements of the bishops. The Bishop Scharfenberger, who represents, I think, a diocese in upstate New York, had a very strong statement, which I thought was quite good.
Good.
Again, it seemed that the Catholic Conference was clear in their opposition, but the fact that the legislature flipped from Republican to Democrat just made it very difficult politically for this bill to be stopped.
Okay, so this is a result of the November elections.
Yes.
Okay. So again,
And I think it's kind of a good warning for pro-lifers that ever since the Roe v. Wade decision, by and large, we've been able to go on offense, and our opponents have been on defense. But I think this shows that in a lot of blue states, people who support legal abortion are becoming more aggressive in their desire to expand access to abortion. We saw that in Illinois, where the governor Governor Rauner became the first governor ever to sign legislation that required the state Medicaid program to pay for abortions for pregnant women.
Mm-hmm.
There's also kind of rumblings in Massachusetts. There's some movement there to undo the state's pro-life parental involvement law, which was enacted in the early 1980s. So I think this is kind of a wake-up call. I think that pro-lifers have been able to do some good things in a lot of purple states and red states, but I think we need to be aware of the fact that our opponents are going to be more aggressive, and we need to really take this seriously.
Do you have at your fingertips the history of abortion in New York State? Because as I recall it, New York State was one of the pioneers in liberalizing abortion laws.
Right. Essentially, New York's history is pretty interesting. I would say with the exception of the Roe v. Wade decision, their decision or the vote by the state legislature in 1970 to legalize abortion was probably one of the most important events in the history of abortion politics in the United States. And it was for a couple of reasons. In other states that legalized early, they made it very difficult for women out of state to obtain abortions. California made it difficult. Other states, I'm not sure the exact language, but other states like Hawaii and Alaska were just difficult to get to. New York had no residency requirement. So when they legalized, abortion became a lot more available for women who lived close by.
Okay.
Places like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Massachusetts. It became a lot easier for women in these states to obtain abortions. So there was that. They also realized that a lot of states were kind of thinking about whether or not they should legalize abortion or not. And they knew that their legislation would get a lot of scrutiny. So they did put some safeguards in. And these safeguards are removed by this Reproductive Health Act. The original legislation only allowed abortion through the first two trimesters. Because, again, there's very, very good evidence that health risks increase dramatically when it comes to late-term abortions. The original 1970 legislation only allowed physicians to do abortions. This new legislation allows non-physicians, physician assistants, to do abortions.
So, again, 24 weeks
after New York.
Back in 1970, they were allowing the law allowed abortions through 24 weeks. 24 weeks, okay. This is, again, I'm with you, and want to echo the fact that this was a legislative victory. This was not a judicial victory. And this means, again, that the will of the people, you might say, is being heard here. Were there, did you look at the polling that took place prior to the vote?
Well, I don't think the will of the people is really being reflected here. I think that a lot of Democrats in blue states really overstate the support for legal abortion. There was a push to enact similar legislation 5 years ago The Kiros Girl Foundation did some polling, and it did find that many aspects of this bill were unpopular. I think close to three-fourths opposed abortions after the second trimester. I think 75-80% oppose allowing non-physicians to do abortions. So I don't really think this really reflects the will of your average New Yorker. You know, I think this is kind of a payoff to Planned Parenthood and a lot of their politically, quote-unquote, liberal allies. I think that we just need credible pro-life opposition. It's not necessarily going to be easy, but I think that the Catholic Conference and other pro-life groups need to publicize this, publicize who voted in favor of this bill,
right,
and try to recruit good candidates throughout the next election cycle.
No, I certainly agree with that. When I said the will of the people, I meant it was an act of the legislature, which, yeah, you know, supposedly is supposed to be representing the people as opposed to the judiciary. And so I would think in this case, this represents a more serious threat in that these are people of voting who have recently been elected. And so what you, if I understand you correctly, you're saying, though, that in spite of this legislative victory, the law itself is more permissive than polling would have indicated that people wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your average New York voter would prefer an abortion policy that's much more conservative than what this bill would allow for. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Michael, thank you so much. We turn our attention now to the state of Virginia, where the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, is undergoing a new birth. With me is Olivia Turner, president of the Virginia Society for Human Life. Olivia, good to have you with me. Thanks.
It's wonderful to be with you, Al. Thanks for the opportunity.
So what's happening in the state of Virginia trying to revive the ERA?
Well, this has been something that's been brewing for a couple of years. There have been efforts around the United States to bring the ERA back to life, even though the Supreme Court ruled very clearly in 1982 that the time was up for Congress or for the states to ratify it. And yet, there are a determined group of people, mostly pro-abortion advocates like the ACLU, the National Abortion Rights Action League, Planned Parenthood, and others, National Organization for Women. All these groups have been soundly trying to pretend that the decision didn't mean what it meant. So for 4 years now, they've been trying to do it in Virginia. This year, because our General Assembly is so very, very tightly divided with a one or two vote majority in either the House or the Senate side and a pro-abortion governor in place, they felt that they could use this as a wedge issue because it's also an election year here in Virginia. So it has become a lightning rod issue, and it's causing a great deal of anxiety among our elected officials.
Now, it's roughly 50 words, as I remember, and I've got a text in front of me. Let me just quickly read it. Equality of rights under the law should not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. This amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. On the face of it, it sounds pretty innocent. Why are you concerned?
Well, it's very simple, Al. You're right. It sounds so innocent, so proper and good,
right,
except that we know from cases that have been decided in other parts of the country that an effective ERA in a state situation, state law, can be used and has been used to strip away pro-life laws. The most profound and powerful decision was from New Mexico with NARAL and New Mexico Right to Choose versus the state of New Mexico. And the decision there was that the state could not prohibit the use of taxpayer dollars to pay for all abortions in the state of New Mexico. That subsequently also rang true in Connecticut and Washington State. And most recently, last week, Al, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which also has an ERA, they were challenged. The state ERA was challenged by the Women's Law Project and Planned Parenthood Federation of Virginia to overrule their Medicaid laws that prohibit taxpayer funding under those programs in Pennsylvania. They also asked in their court challenge that the human right to abortion be enshrined in the Pennsylvania Constitution. So this is definitely an attack on the rights of states to pass protective and reasonable pro-life laws. And even Justice Ginsburg acknowledged in 2015 in her own book that the ratification of the ERA would mean that immediately at least 800 laws, pro-life laws, would be overturned and thrown on the ash heap of history. So there you have it.
Wow. So this is a shorthand way of eliminating so much of the pro-life legislation that we've worked hard on over the last 20 years.
Oh, even more than that, since the 1989 decision in Webster.
The Webster decision. I was thinking right. Planned Parenthood v. Casey, but yes.
No, but it was the Webster decision that opened the door to the states to attempt to pass these reasonable laws.
That's right.
And now we know that this is an end run that they're trying to do. Last year, Illinois, and the year before that, Nevada, passed the ERA. So even though certain states rescinded, we now have Illinois on record and Nevada. So the last state that they need is Virginia, if
wow.
it's ratified in Virginia. It is frightening, because if it's ratified here, and if this rather questionable Supreme Court were to decide to take it up and accept it, and if it were accepted and therefore ratified to the United States Constitution, what's happening here in Virginia will affect the entire 50 states.
Yeah.
So what just happened in New York, which is horrific, will be the reality all across the United States. So we are really anxiously, you know, urging Virginians to wake up, pay attention, communicate with their legislators right now.
Let me ask you,
close to filling it.
Right. Let me ask you once again, where are we in Virginia? There was a panel that voted something down just yesterday, I think.
Yes, Al, there was a subcommittee meeting of a committee called the Privileges and Elections Committee. That subcommittee soundly is a member. Members there were very pro-life, very aware of the dangers of the ERA, and under the leadership of Chairman Margaret Branson, they did vote to what we call PBI, which means to pass by indefinitely, which effectively should shut down the debate on the bill. However, we know from Eileen Davis, the leader of this ERA proponents organization in Virginia, that they intend to try to raise it tomorrow morning at the full committee hearing and see if they can bring it back again. It's a challenge. We hope and pray and believe it will be defeated, because the members should be able to see that this is a procedural runaround, but that doesn't mean that we're over then, because the rules in Virginia could allow for a pro-abortion member of the full House to attempt to bring it up on the floor of the full House, perhaps sometime as early next week.
Wow.
So we are really still in the thick of it, even though the victory on Tuesday in the subcommittee was essential to this process. They do not intend to give up on the other side. They are shouting at our legislators, laughing at our legislators, even physically accosting our legislators who are opposed to the ERA. And we have a lot of work ahead of us here.
What's the website people can get more information, Olivia?
Easy. It's VSHL.org. That stands for Virginia Society for Human Life. .org,
All right.
VSHL.org, and there's a petition there. There's a way to connect directly to your legislator, find out who he or she is. Make your voices heard now, because I assure you, the other side is very, very loud, and they are making themselves very present to our legislators.
Olivia, thanks for joining me today. We'll stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Al.
Yeah. Let's get over there to VSHL.org. This is, again, we've said before, those champions of abortion are out there, and they are they're encouraged by the November election and making all kinds of new initiatives. So check it out, vshl.org.
Finding a doctor who respects your faith can be hard. Consider Emmaus Health, providing primary care and mental health services for the entire family. Now, in conjunction with St. Joseph Mercy Health System, Emmaus is proud to introduce Dr. Steve Hickner, an OBGYN who is NAPRO-trained to manage infertility. Call 734-930-4020. Visit our website at emmaushealth.org or come visit us at Domino's Farms Lobby L. Faith-inspired, dignity-affirming health care. Emmaus Health.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shields, on the struggles of compromising that leads to a failure of growing with the Lord.
Brothers and sisters, you really can make decisions that bring clarity. Don't just live with the status quo. Don't just say, well, this is the kind of person I am. These are my strengths, these are my weaknesses. It's fine to say that. But So many of us, I think, feel like, well, this is the way I've always been, or this is my personality, or whatever. To excuse ourselves from confronting, am I really following the Lord, or do I have my feet in two different camps, the world and God, the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of the earth? Do I have my 2 feet in one place, or am I straddling? And if I'm straddling, you're always going to compromise. You're always going to try to find a way through that salves your conscience, but in fact, you're trying to serve two masters. And it won't work. So I want to urge you to take a look. Don't just listen to these readings and say, oh, I should think about this sometime. Think about it today.
Sister Ann Shields gives you food for the journey, weekday mornings at 6:45 and again at 11:30 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for joining me this first hour. We've got another great hour coming up. We're opening the phone lines, and for the first time, we're going to discuss what happened at the Lincoln Memorial on Friday. We'll talk about the Covington Catholic High School kids, the Native American activist Nathan Phillips, and the Black Hebrew Israelites. It's hard to quote them without some buzzers going off. But that's what's coming up in the next hour. We'll take your calls at 1-877-573-7825. 1-877-573-7825. I'd like to hear especially from any chaperones listening. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.